Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode all throughout the duration of today's call. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this point. Now I'll turn the meeting over to the Department of Education. You may begin.
Good afternoon and good morning to those of you on the West Coast. Thank you for joining us for the third pre-application webinar for the National Professional Development Grant Competition. This is the third in a series of the three webinars designed to review the application process, competition priorities, and evidence criteria, as well as to answer any questions you may have about the grant competition. My name is Elizabeth Judd, and I'm a program officer for the NPD program in the Office of English Language Acquisition here at the U.S. Department of Education. Joining me on this webinar are my colleagues here in OELA, Sam Lopez, team leader for NPD, and Steve Van Pelt, program officer for NPD. Also joining us is Daphne Garcia, associate research scientist with Institute of Education Science, IES, here at the U.S. Department of Education. Now, for a few housekeeping points, you must dial into the conference line in order to hear the webinar. Hopefully, everyone can hear us clearly. Also, please note that all phone lines will be placed on mute throughout the presentation. This webinar series is intended to provide technical assistance to applicants preparing applications for the NPD 2016 grant competition. However, all potential applicants should review the Notice Inviting Applications, also known as the NIA, in the Federal Register. The NIA is the best source for information regarding the NPD 2016 grant competition. In addition, detailed application instructions can be located on grants.gov by searching for the NPD grant competition by CFDA number 84.365Z. Application instructions can also be found on the NPD applicant information site on the OELA website. Go to www.ed.gov/OELA and click on the NPD 2016 competition under What's New, and it will take you directly to the applicant information site. As mentioned, this is the third and final of the webinars. The first webinar was held on December 16th, and the second webinar was held January 13th. If you missed the webinars, you can find the PowerPoint slides and audio recordings on the NPD website listed here. We encourage all interested applicants to review the series, as we will be addressing different information in each webinar. Please note that all webinars are being recorded. The slides and audio will be posted on the NPD applicant information site. During our webinar today, all phone lines will be on mute. However, we encourage you to submit questions in the chat box as we present. The chat box is located on the right side of your screen. We will do our best to answer your questions as we move through the slides, though we have reserved some time at the end of the webinar for general Q&A session. In addition, we encourage you to review the frequently asked questions on the NPD website. The first webinar in December focused on providing potential applicants with a brief overview of the NPD 2016 grant competition, including the application process, selection criteria, competition priorities, budget information, and other resources. Last week's webinar focused on Government Performance and Reporting Act performance measures, known as GEPRA, and reviewed the selection criteria that detailed how their applications will be rated and scored by panel reviewers who will read and score your applications. Today's webinar will provide a brief overview of the competition priorities, then go in depth into competitive preference priority one, moderate evidence of effectiveness, as well as discuss the evidence criteria in project evaluation. Again, The webinars will be recorded and archived on the NPD Applicant Information site. Now, over to my colleague, Sam Lopez.
Hello. These are the topics we plan to cover in today's webinar. The next few slides will provide a brief overview of the NPD program priority. All applicants must address the absolute priority, which, as noted here, speaks to the design and implementation of a professional development program that serves to improve the instruction of ELs. The application will not be read if your project design does not address the absolute priority. There are two competitive preference priorities for which an applicant may receive additional points. The competitive preference priorities are, one, moderate evidence of effectiveness, and two, improving parent, family, and community engagement. CPP1 on moderate evidence of effectiveness will be reviewed and scored by the department. CPP2 on improving parent, family, and community engagement will be reviewed and scored by the peer reviewers. Finally, there are two invitational priorities. These are, one, dual language approaches, and two, supporting the early learning workforce to serve ELs. Applicants are free to address any or all of the competitive preference or invitational priorities. The invitational priorities do not earn the applicant any additional points. Applicants should address the priorities in the application narrative. As stated previously, all applicants must address absolute priority, which, as noted here, speaks to the design and implementation of an educational program that serves to improve the instruction of ELs and professional development activities that help to assist educational personnel working with ELs to meet high professional standards. Applications that do not address the absolute priority will not be read. Applicants who choose to address competitive preference priority one may receive an additional 5 points as part of their total final score on their application rating. Applicants addressing CPP1, moderate evidence, should identify up to 2 citations of studies that meet the definition of moderate evidence of effectiveness and relate to the program. The definition of moderate evidence appears under the additional definition section at the bottom of the FAQs. Cited studies must be included in both the application narrative and the application abstract. The review of CPP1, moderate evidence of effectiveness, and points awarded for this section will be conducted by the department. We will discuss CPP1 at length shortly. Now, here's Steve to talk about CPP2 and the invitational priorities.
Thanks, Sam. Hi, everybody. Literature suggests that educators who involve families in their children's education can strengthen their instructional effectiveness with English learners. Providing professional development that enhances educators' abilities to build meaningful relationships with students' families may also support students' learning at home. Accordingly, the NPD grant competition includes a competitive preference priority related to improving parent, family, and community engagement. Applicants who choose to address competitive priority 2 may receive up to an additional 5 points as part of their total final score in their application rating. This priority is intended to improve students' outcomes by designing and implementing one or more of the following activities. Projects that develop and implement systemic initiatives to expand and enhance skills, strategies, and knowledge of parents and families, including the use of technology tools needed to effectively communicate and support and make informed decisions about the student. Projects that provide professional development to enhance the competencies of all school personnel in general, as well as build meaningful relationships among students' parents or families that support student learning, or projects that implement community engagement initiatives between families and school staff in an effort to cultivate sustained partnerships. Again, applicants should address one or more of the aforementioned activities. The department is also interested in supporting dual language acquisition approaches that are effective in developing biliteracy skills. Evidence suggests that students who are biliterate have certain cognitive and social benefits compared to their monolingual peers. Further, recent research suggests that despite initial lags, students in well-implemented dual language programs eventually perform equal to or better than their counterparts in English-only programs. We encourage applicants to propose projects to improve educator preparation and professional learning for dual language implementation models to support effective instruction for ELs. In particular, we encourage such approaches to take into account the unique needs of recently arrived limited English proficient students, immigrant children and youth, and Native American students who are members of federally recognized Indian tribes. Finally, we are interested in the development of the early learning workforce. In this competition, we encourage pre-service preparation for early learning educators so that they can successfully support ELs. And because the foundational knowledge of developmental learning and language acquisition skills applies across all levels of teaching ELs, including at the secondary level, we also encourage projects that will include this knowledge building for educators at all levels. Now, here is Daphne to talk about the evidence and evaluation criteria.
Thank you, Steve. I will start off with a quick overview of what we mean by entry and exit evidence criteria. In this webinar, we will use the terms entry and exit evidence criteria when referring to the evidence that is required as part of this grant. The entry evidence criteria refer to the study or studies that support what the applicant proposes to implement as part of their NPD program design. The purpose of the entry criteria is to encourage applicants to use evidence of effectiveness as a part of their NPD grant application. Competitive preference priority one on moderate evidence is the entry evidence. Alternatively, exit evidence criteria refers to the applicant's project evaluation. The department is seeking to expand the knowledge base on effective professional development practices for educators of ELs. The applicant's project evaluation, as detailed in Section D of the application narrative, represents the exit criteria for this grant. Now I will specifically discuss the competitive preference priority for moderate evidence of effectiveness. The intervention, and by intervention we mean a process, product, strategy, or practice, proposed in the National Professional Development Grant application must be supported by moderate evidence of effectiveness to receive points under Competitive Preference Priority 1. We want to stress that the research you cite in your applications, the entry evidence, must be relevant to the effectiveness of the intervention being proposed. The Education Department General Administrative Regulations, EDGAR, defines what qualifies as moderate evidence of effectiveness. To meet the moderate evidence of effectiveness eligibility requirement for grants, one of the following two conditions must be met. Option one means that there is at least one study of effectiveness of the process, product, strategy, or practice being proposed that meets the What Works Clearinghouse evidence standards without reservations, found a statistically significant favorable impact on a relevant outcome, with no statistically significant or overriding unfavorable impacts on that outcome for relevant populations in the study or in other studies of the intervention reviewed by and reported on by the What Works Clearinghouse, and includes a sample that overlaps with the populations or settings proposed to receive the process, product, or strategy. Option two means that there is at least one study of effectiveness of the process, product, strategy, or practice being proposed that meets the What Works Clearinghouse standards with reservations, found a statistically significant favorable impact on a relevant outcome, includes a sample that overlaps with the population or settings proposed to receive this process, product, strategy, or practice, and includes a large sample and a multi-site sample. According to EDGAR, a large sample is 350 individual students, faculty, or counselors, or 50 groupings of individuals, for example, schools or colleges. Multi-site means more than one school or campus. Under option two, applicants can meet the large sample and multi-site criteria by aggregating across the two studies they cite, as long as both meet the other criteria of option two. In other words, they can submit one study conducted in one school district or school and another study conducted in another district or school, and that would meet the multi-site criterion. It is important for applicants to understand that finding a study that meets What Works Clearinghouse standards alone is not enough to meet the eligibility requirements for moderate evidence of effectiveness. An application for an NPD grant must be supported by modern evidence of effectiveness as described in the previous slide to receive 5 additional points for competitive preference priority 1. Applicants should identify up to 2 study citations to be reviewed against WWC evidence standards for the purpose of meeting CPP 1. Applicants should clearly identify these citations in the application narrative and the application abstract. Note that the department will not review any study citations that an applicant fails to clearly identify in this manner for the evidence review. So how to identify relevant studies? There are 2 key ways to identify relevant studies that can be submitted as part of your application. One option is to submit studies that have been reviewed as part of the IES practice guide, teaching academic and literacy to English learners in elementary and middle school. You can access this guide at the link above. If you choose to locate a study through the practice guide, you will need to follow multiple steps to identify a study that may meet the moderate evidence of effectiveness requirement. Please note that not all studies in the practice guide will meet the requirements for CPP1, so a thorough review is necessary. To begin your search, first, locate Appendix D on pages 85 through 102. Define studies that provide evidence for the recommendations in the guide. Here you will find a list of the supporting studies, nature of the intervention, and outcomes measured, and the effect sizes. After you've identified a study, you will need to locate it in the WWC database of reviewed studies on the WWC website under the Resources tab to see the study's What Works Clearinghouse rating. Please note, this database will provide you with a study rating, but you will need to examine the practice guide tables in Appendix D and or the original study to determine whether the study meets the moderate evidence requirements, such as whether the study includes a large multi-site sample or found a positive impact. As a second option, applicants can also propose to use studies that are not included in the Teaching Academic and Literacy to English Learners in Elementary and Middle School Practice Guide, provided that these studies meet the WWC standards and the other eligibility requirements for moderate evidence of effectiveness. You can use the same review studies database to search for studies that are not mentioned in the practice guide, but that may have been reviewed by the WWC. Any studies that have not been reviewed by the WWC will undergo a review to see if they meet the moderate evidence priority. Next, I will go over some basic characteristics of the kinds of studies that can be submitted as moderate evidence of effectiveness. The only kinds of studies that can be submitted as moderate evidence of effectiveness and that have the potential to meet WWC standards must focus on an intervention, so a program, practice, or strategy, and whether it is effective. Studies that are not eligible to be reviewed by the WWC include those that solely identify a problem, for example, the growing size of achievement gaps, track how outcomes at a particular school or school district have changed over time, link different phases of student or faculty experiences to each other, for example, reading well by third grade predicts graduating from high school, or describe how a new strategy was put in place, for example, the steps using data-based decision-making. These ineligible studies may help document a need for an intervention, but they do not indicate whether the intervention can be plausibly linked to higher or lower student outcomes. In order for the WWC to determine if a study meets the standards, the evidence applicants submit must be the full technical study, report, or article, not a brief or summary version. Literature reviews or meta-analyses summarize across studies, making it impossible to review each study individually. When applicants submit studies for review, the WWC decides on the appropriate protocol to guide the review for the study. The WWC uses topic-specific protocols such as a post-secondary education, teacher training, evaluation and compensation, early childhood, etc., to guide all reviews. If a relevant topic-specific protocol does not exist, the WWC will use the broader single study review protocol to guide the review. Understanding how studies can meet the WWC standards and other aspects of moderate evidence of effectiveness is new for many of ED's grant applicants. But there are some resources available on the WWC's website under the Resources tab, such as webinars, review protocols, and standards briefs that explain the rules the WWC uses to evaluate the quality of studies. I want to close this section by describing how the evidence reviews for entry criteria are conducted. All of the evidence eligibility reviews are conducted by IES. IES WWC contractors trained in the WWC Evidence Standards version 3.0 assess the citations that applicants provide in support of Competitive Preference Priority 1. IES reports the WWC review as well as information about the intervention, sample, and setting for each study reviewed to OELA so that OELA representatives can make a final determination about whether the application includes a sufficient number and quality of studies to meet the applicable evidence standard, including the relevance of the intervention, sample, and setting in the cited evidence to what the applicant has proposed. This slide both reviews and provides more detail about what to include in your application to support the department's review of CPP-1. Applicants must ensure that the evidence they are citing is available to the department. As such, we ask applicants to provide explicit links or other guidance, such as a full reference citation, indicating where the evidence is available. Additionally, if you can do so, it would greatly facilitate the review process if applicants could include the evidence itself, for example, the report or journal article in Section 6, Other Forms, of their application. Remember that the evidence standards refer to studies of effectiveness of the intervention being proposed. Thus, please ensure that the citations you include are studies of the intervention being proposed. It is not acceptable to cite literature in a general education topic area or studies of a similar intervention rather than studies supporting the specific intervention being proposed. Lastly, there are no restrictions under NPD regarding the source of the evidence. In other words, the applicant can cite research conducted by another entity. Now I will turn it over to Sam.
Well,
we're actually going to pause briefly to answer some of the questions that have been coming in our initial slides. One of the first questions we received was in reference to whether or not an external evaluator was recommended or required. There is no requirement to use an external evaluator. The department cannot comment or provide an opinion or advice on the strengths or weaknesses of a particular approach, including the use of an external or an internal evaluator. Applicants, in devising their evaluation plan, should determine what the most appropriate way is of obtaining a quality evaluation. Another question we received was in reference to the RFP, or the NIA, and the development of program curriculum as one of the allowable uses of NPD funds, and whether or not this applied to in-service training for educators. Indeed, NPD grants can be used for supporting either pre-service or in-service activities. We also received another question regarding annual meetings. Yes. Under the National Professional Development Grant, similar to many other grants in the department, an annual director's meeting is held as part of our technical assistance and support to grantees once awarded. There was a request from someone to include the references to EDGAR when we post this information online. We can do that when we post our updated FAQs following the webinar. And we'll go ahead and continue on with the webinar, read through some additional questions, and address those throughout the remaining of the webinar and at the conclusion. So I'll turn it back over to Sam.
Thank you, Mariana. Now we will review the criteria for the NPD grant program evaluation. As discussed in webinar 1 and 2, section D of your application narrative, quality of project evaluation, it is worth up to 20 points and has 3 sub-factors. The first sub-factor focuses on the extent to which the methods of evaluation are thorough, feasible, and appropriate to the goals, objectives, and outcomes of the proposed project. The second sub-factor focuses on the extent to which the methods of evaluation will, if well implemented, produce evidence about the project's effectiveness that would meet the What Works Clearinghouse evidence standards with reservations. Daphne will discuss this further in the subsequent slides. The third sub-factor focuses on the extent to which the methods of evaluation will provide performance feedback and permit periodic assessment of progress toward achieving intended outcomes. This section will be read and scored by a reviewer with expertise in educational evaluation. And now back to Daphne.
The notices require that all NPD evaluations must be able to meet WWC standards with reservations. This means that all evaluations should be designed to have a comparison or control group, a strategy for matching participants, and a statistical model for analyzing data. The WWC evidence standards focus on the following 3 key issues. The first concerns the nature of the study design and how it was implemented. The concern here is whether the design is one that supports causal conclusions. The second concern is the quality of the data, particularly the outcome measures. The third concerns whether the analysis was conducted in a manner that leads to a reliable impact estimate. Please note, there are other factors that may affect whether a study meets WWC standards, and I will discuss some of these later. The first and highest rating given by the WWC is meets What Works Clearinghouse standards without reservations. Only randomized controlled trials can receive this rating. Randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, is similar to a clinical trial where a group eligible for and interested in the intervention is randomly assigned, like a flip of a coin or a lottery, to either participate or not. The effect or impact is measured as the difference between the two groups and their outcomes. Because the participant and the comparison group are created randomly, they should be equivalent before participating on characteristics that researchers can measure and those they can't measure. This ensures that any difference observed between the two groups can be attributed solely to the intervention. For meets What Works Clearinghouse standards with reservations, a quasi-experimental study, a QED, creates a non-randomized comparison group by matching non-participants to a group of participants so that the two groups are similar in certain ways before anyone had a chance to participate in the intervention. We have less confidence in QEDs because that process of matching cannot account for all the differences between the two groups. Only the information researchers have available in data. It's usually not possible to match on important qualities that are strongly linked to being willing to participate in the intervention and the outcomes, things like grit and motivation. So the effect measured in a QED can include pre-existing differences between the two groups and not just the influence of the strategy itself. This is why we have reservations about QEDs. Sometimes an RCT has a problem as carried out, and in these cases it will be treated like a QED. For studies that don't meet What Works Clearinghouse standards, typically this is because the participant group and the comparison group in a QED are not shown to be similar before the intervention, what we refer to as at baseline. But there can be other reasons that seems like a QED or RCT doesn't meet WWC standards. And of course, many studies that claim to be about effectiveness don't even start with a participant and a comparison or control group. For the WWC, having distinct groups is necessary because the effect of the intervention is measured as a difference in outcomes between the two groups. The WWC standards require that the comparison group be from the same time period as the intervention or participant group, more on why in a minute, and there has to be a real comparison group, not just the same group of students, schools, teachers, compared to themselves over time. The two groups can be created randomly or non-randomly. Now I want to highlight two key cautions and provide some more specifics about the attrition and equivalence standards. First, when offering randomized controlled trials as evidence in support of the intervention in your application, we caution you to pay attention to sample attrition, as this affects how the evidence will be judged in the review process. Randomly assigning study participants to an intervention and comparison groups creates groups with similar characteristics at the start of the study. When the two groups have similar characteristics at baseline, differences in outcomes between the two groups at the follow-up can be attributed to the intervention. However, if attrition occurs, the members of the intervention and comparison group used in the analysis may not have had similar characteristics at the start of the study, preventing us from being able to attribute any differences in outcomes solely to the intervention. To understand why attrition is important, imagine the students represented by the red circles in the figure typically score higher than other students. Having more high-achieving students in the intervention group at follow-up implies that we would likely find a higher average score for the intervention group than for the comparison group, even if the intervention was not effective at changing student performance. Therefore, the observed effect of the intervention is biased. Some of the differences in the outcomes stem from the differences between the intervention and the comparison groups due to attrition. So RCTs with high levels of attrition cannot meet evidence standards without reservations and must demonstrate baseline equivalence to meet standards with reservations. The WWC examines two kinds of attrition in its review: attrition for all study participants, so overall attrition, and differences in attrition between the intervention and comparison groups, referred to as differential attrition, as illustrated in the figure above. Please refer to the WWC handbook for more information on how to calculate attrition. A second caution is to pay attention to the baseline equivalence of the treatment and comparison groups for all quasi-experimental design studies, as well as RCTs with high attrition. If these studies meet the baseline equivalence standards, they may be rated as meeting evidence standards with reservations. If not, then they will not meet WWC evidence standards. When two groups are similar at the start of a study and after that, the only difference between the groups is that one receives the intervention and the other does not, it is reasonable to conclude that any difference in the outcomes that are measured at the end of the study, the follow-up, are caused by the intervention. However, if the two groups are different at the baseline on key characteristics that could influence the outcome, the effect found at the end of the study might be due to the differences that already existed at the beginning. Demonstrating baseline equivalence is important in studies that did not assign participants randomly to the intervention and comparison groups. It is also important in random assignment studies with high attrition. In the example on the slide, students in the intervention group had a higher academic achievement than those in the comparison group during the follow-up period, suggesting a positive program impact. However, we need to look back in time and examine the baseline achievement for the sample of individuals analyzed at follow-up. This group is referred to as the analytic sample. The group started out at very different achievement levels. The intervention group had more high-achieving individuals than the comparison group at baseline. Therefore, the observed program impact may be biased. Some of the differences in outcomes may result from having different types of students across the intervention and comparison groups. Each WWC protocol specifies the characteristics on which equivalence must be established at baseline. For academic outcomes, baseline equivalence is often established using a pre-intervention test. Some outcomes, such as high school graduation, do not have a pre-intervention measure. For these outcomes, the WWC often requires baseline equivalence for related demographic characteristics, such as age. The WWC uses a standardized mean difference called an effect size to determine whether there is baseline equivalence between the intervention and comparison groups. The effect size is calculated as the difference between the intervention group mean and the comparison group mean, divided by the pooled standard deviation. The figure on this slide illustrates this calculation. A third caution is that even if a study shows evidence of equivalence on a baseline measure of the outcome variable that is closely related characteristics, it may not meet WWC evidence standards for other reasons. For example, if there is evidence that the population being compared are drawn from very different settings, for example, one group is predominantly rural and the other largely urban. These groups may be judged to be too dissimilar to result in an adequate comparison sample. Now I will turn it back to Sam.
In the next few slides, we will be reviewing valuable resources and important reminders.
But before that, we're going to go ahead and jump in with a few more questions that we have been receiving. Some of you asked for us to repeat the information about annual meetings. So it is standard practice in the department for all grants to have annual meetings generally held here in Washington, D.C., or the nearby area. And our annual grantee meetings have recently included both the project director and the evaluator. We have also received a few questions regarding specific program designs. And unfortunately, the department cannot provide an opinion or advice on the strengths or weaknesses of a particular approach an applicant would like to take in preparing this proposal for the NPD competition. Applicants should closely review the NIA and on that basis develop a proposal that addresses the priorities and selection criteria. In doing so, applicants must use their own judgment in designing a project that responds to the NIA and is appropriate and effective in addressing the specific circumstances and challenges they face. We would also direct you back to webinar 2, where we outline the specific selection criteria on which your applications will be reviewed, and how the reviewers will review and score your applications. And to that point, we did receive another question about whether the study under the project evaluation needs to meet the criteria, the WWC criteria, that Daphne just went over. Indeed, that is included in the selection criteria. And we'll go ahead and continue on with Steve.
Okay, thanks, Mariana. A reminder that NPD competition information can be found on the NPD applicant information site. In addition to our three pre-application webinars, IES, the Institute of Education Sciences, has two pre-recorded webinars on designing and executing rigorous studies. You may want to view those as you prepare to write your application narrative. REL Southwest is also currently conducting a series of 5 webinars specifically focused on professional development program evaluations. You may find these particularly helpful as they focus exclusively on designing evaluation of professional development. Liz?
Oh, actually, I'm going to go ahead and add that as we have been in our office watching the REL webinars, they have been incredibly helpful and would encourage you to also do the same, particularly as we have been receiving a number of questions regarding how to interpret or use student achievement data as part of their professional development evaluation design. Liz?
Thanks, Mariana. A few important dates to note. As you know, applications became available on December 11th. We held our first webinar shortly thereafter, and today is the final webinar in the series. Applications are due February 19th. Applications will be then reviewed, and the department will make awards in July. Your grant period can begin after awards are announced. Applications are due by 4:30 Washington, D.C. time on February 19th and must be submitted electronically via the grants.gov system. That process was outlined in Webinar 1. At this time, we would like to open it up to your questions. Please submit your questions via the chat box on the right of the screen.
Thank you, Liz. We're actually going to go ahead and put the call line on mute so that we can read through your questions and come back and answer as many as we can. So if we could please ask you to hold on just a few short minutes for us, and we will be back. thank you for waiting patiently for us. We're going to go ahead and scroll back to slide 15, which sets the stage for the evidence components in the competition, both the entry and the evidence, entry and exit evidence criteria. And I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to Daphne to talk a little bit about that and clarify some of those points for some of you who submitted questions.
Right, and just to review, so when we talk about the entry criteria, we're talking about the evidence that applicants are submitting supporting the intervention that they're proposing in their actual application. So those are the two studies that you're going to be providing citations for, or the actual studies that need to meet the different evidence criteria that are outlined in the NIA and in this presentation. And so that includes meeting What Works Clearinghouse standards, either with or without reservations, and depending on what the rating is, then there are requirements both regarding the sample size, and whether the sample is multi-site. Also, all studies that are submitted for as evidence under the moderate evidence for the entry criteria need to have statistically significant positive findings. Now,
I'm going to pause there, too, just to again clarify that because the entry criteria is a competitive preference priority, it is an option, it's not required. If you write to the competitive preference priority, you meet that competitive preference priority, you would gain an additional 5 points in your application as it is compared to other applications submitted by the department. So again, it's not a requirement, it is an option as part of the competitive preference priority points that you can earn to position your application.
Correct. Thank you, Mariana. And the exit criteria that we're referring to here is regarding the overall evaluation of your entire professional development project. And so one of those criteria for that evaluation is that it meet What Works Clearinghouse standards with reservations. So that means either you're doing an RCT that maybe experiences high levels of attrition or a quasi-experimental design. And so I know that some folks did have questions about specific designs and about some studies that would qualify as part of the entry criteria. So I think we're going to go forward to slide, I believe it was 23, which provides an overview of what kind of studies qualify under the moderate evidence entry criteria. And so somebody asked specifically whether a case study would qualify. And I think depending on how the case study was done, that whether or not it meets the moderate evidence criteria might vary. So most case studies focus on one specific occurrence, whereas the clearinghouse requires that there be a comparison group and a group that has received a treatment group that actually receives the intervention. So a case study that focuses on only one observation, either one student or one teacher or one school, would most likely not be able to meet What Works Clearinghouse standards. Now, other examples of studies and reports that wouldn't meet the clearinghouse standards would include newspaper articles found in magazines, literature reviews, briefs, summaries, any secondary analysis that's been done. All evidence that the clearinghouse will consider for review has to be original research studies. And it doesn't matter whether it's peer-reviewed or not, but the full technical document needs to be provided, or the citation for that full technical document needs to be provided. Now, folks ask whether the intervention comparison groups can be of teachers or if they have to be of students. The answer is yes, because especially for evaluations that will be done as part of the exit criteria, we're asking you to evaluate your overall professional development project, not the specific intervention that you might be training teachers to implement with students.
We're going to go ahead and pause for a second and come back and review some of your questions and provide some answers. So we have been receiving a number of questions related to the project evaluation. So we're going to go ahead and move forward to slide 28, which reviews the selection criteria. The selection criteria, again, is how the peer reviewers will review and score your evaluations. And they will determine that by subfactor 1, the extent to which the methods of evaluation are thorough, feasible, and appropriate to the goals, objectives, and outcomes of the proposed project. Applicants will set their goals, objectives, and outcomes for their proposed project. The second subfactor that the reviewers will consider is the extent to which the methods of evaluation will, if well implemented, produce evidence about the project's effectiveness that would meet the What Works Clearinghouse evidence standards with reservations that Daphne reviewed today. And also subfactor 3, the extent to which the methods of evaluation will provide performance feedback and permit periodic assessment of progress toward achieving intended outcomes. It will be up to individual applicants to determine the focus of their project's evaluation as it relates to the selection criteria outlined here. So we're going to go ahead and pause again and see if we can read through a few more of your questions and try to address those. So thank you for being patient and holding. Daphne has a few questions and answers for you.
So we received one question that reads, is it acceptable to compare a group within one district with a group in a different district? And the answer to that would be no. So this design scenario would not meet WWC design standards. The analytic sample should include at least two districts in each condition. If there's a single unit in either the intervention group or the comparison group, then the study will not meet WWC group standards due to a confounding factor. The WWC Procedures Standards Handbook indicates, for example, that if all of the intervention group schools are from a single school district, the district would constitute a confounding factor. So we need to have at least one or two groups in each of the, either the intervention or the comparison group. Another question we received is, if a study meets WWC standards, does that mean it has a positive effect? And the answer is no. A study meeting standards implies that the findings are credible based on the WWC's definition of a well-executed study. However, the impacts of the intervention on outcomes of interest can still be negative, positive, or indistinguishable when compared with the outcomes of those not receiving the intervention. After clarifying whether a study meets standards, WWC products further summarize whether a study showed positive, negative, or no impacts on participant outcomes.
We're going to go ahead and hold and see if we can come back with another couple questions in our last few minutes. thank you again for being patient with us. We continue to receive questions regarding the subject of the project evaluation. The subject of your or subjects of your project evaluation can be the educators of English learners that are participants in your professional development, which may be teachers or other educators, principals, whomever is in your professional development design, or they can be the students that they serve. Could be either or. We have also received a number of questions specific to the WWC criteria, evaluation design. What we will do is we will go back and read through all of your questions and update our frequently asked questions on our website. If you have a specific question that was not answered today and you would like a specific response back to you, we encourage you to please send us your question via our npd2016@ed.gov email address. So again, that is npd2016@ed.gov. If you email that email address directly, we will reply to you directly. Otherwise, we will gather and read through all of your questions and update our FAQs as quickly as possible. The last point that I would want to share back is we are receiving some questions about how applications will be scored and ranked. I would refer you back to the slides and the audio recording from Webinar 2, which we held last week, which outlined the review process and how your applications will be rated and scored by reviewers and ranked for possible funding. We again thank you very much for participating with us in this webinar series, and we are looking forward to receiving your applications on February 19th. Please communicate with us via our NPD 2016 email inbox, and a thank you to Daphne and our colleagues here in Noella for their support throughout this webinar series. Thank you and have a great afternoon.
Thank you, and that concludes today's conference. Thank you all for joining. You may now disconnect.